Episode 80, The Mexican-American War. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. Okay, just to be clear here, in this episode, I'm talking about the Mexican-American War that happened from 1846 to 1848, not the current battle that's taking place on the U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S. is evidently losing that current battle, which I guess is kind of payback for how easily the U.S. won the war back in the 1840s. Evidently, the cartels currently have a better strategy than the Republic of Mexico had back in the day. The Mexican-American War, though it was short, does have a big impact on the world, in part because of the huge chunk of territory that America acquires, and in part because it brings up the idea of civil disobedience. You know I'm going to have to come back to that. Part of the reason for the war goes back to the founding of the Republic of Texas, and the sort of undefined resolution of the Texas War of Independence. At the end of the war, Texas claimed that the Rio Grande was the border between Texas and Mexico. But Mexico claimed that the border was instead the Nueces River, which is about 150 miles north of the Rio Grande. The Nueces River empties into Corpus Christi Bay, which is where the city of Corpus Christi is currently. Mexico wanted the coastline and they wanted access to the bay more than they wanted the land that was in between the rivers. A lot of that land is actually kind of barren, even to this day, and at the time it was very sparsely populated by either Texans or Mexicans. The people that were there in that strip of land were largely of Mexican descent, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they wanted to be part of Mexico. So, when Texas joined the United States in 1845, the United States inherited the dispute over this strip of land. And the United States also wanted to keep control of Corpus Christi Bay. But the United States also wanted to control all of the land to the west of Texas, including what is now New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California. This was loosely held by Mexico, but again, it was sparsely settled, and in reality was mostly inhabited by Indians. But the United States wanted the land. Part of that desire was that congressmen from the South wanted that land to eventually become slave states, since it was south of the southern border of Missouri, which had become the dividing line of slave states and free states after the Missouri Compromise of 1819. But people in the North who opposed slavery could also see this logic, and they were generally opposed to the idea of taking land from Mexico that would potentially become slave states, so those people were against the war. After Texas joined the U.S., Mexico cut off diplomatic relations with the U.S. In 1845, the president, who was James Polk, sent a secret envoy to Mexico City to try to negotiate a deal with Mexico that would settle the border and resolve a couple of ongoing legal claims between the countries. But the envoy, John Slidell, also had another offer with him. Polk had authorized Slidell to offer up to $30 million to purchase New Mexico, Arizona, and California from Mexico. The Mexican president at the time, Jose Joaquin Herrera, who had heard that Slidell was coming with an offer to buy the Mexican land, refused to receive him. When news of this diplomatic snub got back to President Polk, he was apparently quite angry, and so he ordered a U.S. force of about 4,000 troops into Texas and ordered them to occupy the territory between the Rio Grande and the Nueces. Now, this force was commanded by General Zachary Taylor, who had fought in the Seminole Wars under Andrew Jackson, which I mentioned back in episode 76. Taylor, like Jackson, will go on to become president himself, briefly. Anyway, Mexico viewed the incursion into the disputed territory as an invasion, and it sent troops across the Rio Grande. And on April 26, 1846, they attacked an American force and killed 16 men. This was, I suspect, exactly what Polk wanted to happen. In May, he addressed Congress, and he asked for a declaration of war, claiming that American blood had been shed on American soil. And well, from one point of view, that was true. From the Mexican point of view, however, they were legitimately defending their own territory from an invading force. Congress, at the time, was divided into two parties, the Democrats and the Whigs. The Democrats were mostly from the South, and the Whigs were from the North. Generally speaking, the Democrats were in favor of the war, and overall public opinion throughout the United States was in favor of the war, but there was a lot of opposition from Northern Whigs. The Democrats were descendants of Thomas Jefferson's Democratic Republican Party, and they were generally in favor of slavery, and thus were advocates of states' rights rather than big central government. The Whig Party, on the other hand, had been formed in the 1830s as a coalition of smaller groups that were all in opposition to Andrew Jackson, who they viewed as being too tyrannical. The name Whig was borrowed from a similar British political party that had opposed the powers of the King of England, and they wanted to put more power into the hands of Parliament. The American Whigs had also absorbed the anti-Masonic party that John Quincy Adams had joined after he was defeated in his second presidential election. The Whig Party also included a lot of anti-slavery congressmen. They were known as the Conscience Whigs, but there were also some pro-slavery Whigs who were known as the Cotton Whigs. Did they wear a cotton wig? No one seems to know for sure, but they missed a good branding opportunity right there. Anyway, in the 1840s, the Whig Party was beginning to unravel in part because of this split. Some parts of the Whig Party are going to pull out and eventually form the new Republican Party. We're not quite there yet, but we're about to meet the first famous member of the Republican Party. In 1847, there was a first-year member of the House of Representatives from Illinois, from the Whig Party at the time, who introduced some resolutions condemning the Mexican-American War. Interestingly, while this congressman opposed the idea of the United States invading Mexico, he later presides over the United States invading, well, the United States. I'm talking, of course, about Abraham Lincoln. And yes, we are going to be talking about him a lot in the upcoming episodes. Love him or hate him, he's going to dominate the middle of the 1800s. Anyway, in 1847, Lincoln introduced what were known as the Spot Resolutions, which were an attempt to halt the war and to try to determine the exact spot where the fighting had started, basically to make sure that Polk was correct in claiming it had started on American soil. Ultimately, the House of Representatives did not even act or vote on Lincoln's resolutions, but this did enhance Lincoln's reputation as an anti-slavery spokesman. Another famous anti-slavery spokesman that emerged during the Mexican-American War was the poet and author Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau is most famous for his book Walden, which is a series of essays describing his life in a cabin in the woods. At one point during his stay there in this cabin, he journeyed into town to buy some things, and he met a tax collector who asked him to pay his poll tax. A poll tax is a tax that everyone, regardless of income, is supposed to pay. Thoreau politely refused and spent a night in jail. Someone, perhaps his aunt, bailed him out, and that one night in jail convinced Thoreau of the unjustness of the current U.S. government, and it catalyzed him to action. So he wrote a very persuasive essay known as Civil Disobedience. At the time, the essay did not receive all that much attention, but its reputation has grown a lot since then and is now known as one of the best descriptions of man's duty to resist an unjust government. The word civil in civil disobedience does not refer to being polite or respectful or peaceful in the way that you disobey. It refers to civilization or society. So it means disobedience within a society rather than polite disobedience. But people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King also practiced the polite, nonviolent side of being disobedient. So now the phrase kind of means polite disobedience as well. The essay is a justification for not obeying an unjust government when it creates laws that are not just, or tries to take away your liberties, or tries to make you wear a mask or practice social distancing. Thoreau didn't actually address those last things, but I highly encourage you to read the essay, and I think you'll agree he would not have been one of the people wearing a mask during the pandemic. The main idea of the essay is that the U.S. government was being unjust in fighting the Mexican-American War, and it was the duty of just men to resist that. Thoreau compared the government to a machine, and he made the point that when the machine is producing injustice, it was the job of every man to be resistance, to be a type of friction, like a wrench thrown in the gears of a machine, that would stop the machine from producing its intended injustice. In Thoreau's case, the injustice that he saw the machine creating was the ongoing protection of slavery. But the principle applies to anything that the government is doing that just men and women can see is unjust. And one of the important ideas of civil disobedience is that there's a higher law than civil law, and that it's man's duty to obey the higher law, even if it means violating the civil law, and thus suffering the consequences. If everyone in a society disobeys an unjust law, how can the government enforce it? It's the exact type of friction that can stop a machine. Thoreau said, "If an injustice of government is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another man, then I say, break the law. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine." I bet you're waiting for me to say something about our current government, right? And current governments in other parts of the world today. How should we resist? Yeah, I'm actually hoping that you're already thinking that way yourself, thinking about the idea that justice and truth is more important and more valuable than just peace and security and going along with the flow as the government slides towards injustice. A peaceful, secure life is important, and at their best, governments support the rights of their people to have a peaceful, secure life. But at other times, the government becomes an actual threat to a peaceful, secure life. Sometimes governments can be an instrument of justice, protecting people from the whims of mob rule or capricious tyrants or anarchy. But at other times, the government itself becomes the tyrant and imposes injustices on its own people, often protecting the needs and interests of the people in power rather than the needs and interests of the people that the people in power are supposed to represent. These are the same ideals that motivated the founding fathers to sever their ties with the government of Great Britain, which they felt had become unjust. So they resisted. That was Thoreau's point as well, and the point of many other abolitionists at the time of the Mexican-American War. Despite Lincoln, Thoreau, and a few other people's complaints, most of the U.S., however, did support the Mexican-American War. In fact, it was one of those small wars that greatly raised patriotic feeling across the country, sort of like when the U.S. invaded Iraq for no real reason in the Gulf War of 1990. The Mexican-American War was also fueled by this growing manifest destiny feeling that was already spreading across the U.S. that we talked about in a previous episode. So after the American forces in South Texas were attacked, and Congress had agreed to declare war on Mexico, the U.S. sent more troops to Texas, preparing to actually invade Mexico. General Antonio de Padua Maria Severino López de Santa Anna y Pérez de Lebrón, you remember him from the episode on Texas independence? Yep, that same Santa Anna. He was in exile on the island of Cuba, and when he heard about the plans for the U.S. to invade Mexico, he sent someone to contact President Polk. He offered to be a broker of peace and to support the U.S. attempt to purchase New Mexico and Arizona. So President Polk sent a ship to Cuba that took Santa Anna from Cuba to Mexico. But instead of working for peace, Santa Anna actually took control of the Mexican army. As he was getting the Mexican army together, General Taylor and the U.S. troops crossed the Rio Grande and invaded Mexico. The U.S. plan was to have Taylor work his way down to Mexico City and basically force them to surrender. Meanwhile, to the west, another American army, under the command of Colonel Stephen Kearny, moved into the Mexican territories of New Mexico and Arizona and basically occupied that area. There was no resistance to Kearny's advance, and the residents of those areas basically just accepted the American takeover without any resistance at all. General Taylor moved south and fought the only major engagement of the war in the Battle of Buena Vista in February of 1847. In a mountain pass near Monterrey, Mexico, Santa Anna brought about 14,000 troops against Taylor's army of about 5,000. The Americans were dug in well to their position, sort of in a pass there, so they were somewhat protected. So the Mexicans suffered about 1,500 casualties to only about 700 from the Americans. And the Mexicans failed to move the Americans off of their position. In the night, after the battle, the Mexicans left their campfires burning, but the army snuck off in the dark and retreated towards Mexico City. The Americans considered it a victory, though it was really just a draw. They didn't really beat the Mexican army. The Mexicans just snuck off and retreated after the battle. Taylor did not pursue Santa Anna, in part because a lot of his soldiers were sick and many had deserted. President Polk, who was unhappy with Taylor not pursuing Santa Anna, sent another army under the command of General Winfield Scott to land at Veracruz and then march on to Mexico City. Now, Winfield Scott's army captured Veracruz after a couple of weeks of besieging the city and then moved on towards Mexico City. Scott had about 9,000 men, and he met Santa Anna, who had about 12,000 men, at the town of Cerro Gordo, which means Fat Hill. Scott attacked, and he sent a flanking maneuver around the hill that surprised and disoriented the Mexican army, which began to turn and run. That flanking maneuver was suggested by and led by a young colonel named Robert E. Lee, who I also suspect we'll meet again in future episodes. The Mexican army basically collapsed, and Scott captured about 3,000 prisoners. The Mexicans lost over 1,000 men, while the Americans lost about 400. This was effectively the end of the Mexican army, even though Santa Anna escaped again. Sneaky guy, that Santa Anna, always running off as his army's being defeated. After that, Scott's army occupied Mexico City. The Americans had not suffered a lot of casualties in battles, but a lot of Americans had actually died from disease. About 1,500 men total were killed in action, but more than 10,000 died of diseases, mostly yellow fever. Yellow fever is a disease that's spread by mosquitoes, so it's much more common in tropical areas, like much of Mexico, and many of the Americans simply had no immunity to it. Yellow fever causes fevers and eventually kidney failure, which causes jaundice, which makes the skin and the whites of the eyes begin to turn yellow, and as the kidneys fail, you start to turn yellow, hence the name. Once Scott and the army had captured Mexico City, President Polk sent an envoy named Nicholas Trist to Mexico to negotiate a treaty. It took a good while for Mexico to reform a functioning government, and Polk got impatient and recalled Trist to Washington. But Trist stayed on, ignoring his instructions, and he went on to negotiate the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. This treaty, which was ratified eventually by the new Mexican government, ceded New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, parts of Colorado, and the disputed part of Texas to the United States, and in return, the U.S. was to pay $15 million for the land. Even though Trist had been recalled, when news of the treaty got back to Washington, everyone, including Polk, agreed it was a pretty good deal, and the U.S. Congress ratified the treaty as well. So, the U.S. had gotten the Louisiana Purchase for $10 million and the entire U.S. Southwest for $15 million. Pretty good deals there on both of those two land grabs, although getting Manhattan for a handful of beads still might be the best real estate deal ever. So now, basically all of the land west of the Mississippi, north of El Paso, which is at the very western edge of Texas, was now in the hands of the United States. And as I said, these lands weren't very conducive to slavery, although most of the land was south of the Missouri border. But before any of this land can even become a territory, and then bring up the question of whether it will become a slave state, we're going to get to the Civil War. And speaking of the Civil War, there's a pretty long list of generals from the Civil War who first fought in the Mexican-American War. I already mentioned Robert E. Lee, but other Confederate generals who fought for the United States in the Mexican-American War include generals Stonewall Jackson, James Longstreet, George Pickett, Albert Sidney Johnston, Louis Armistead, and P.T. Beauregard. On the eventual Union side, the list includes generals Ulysses S. Grant, George Meade, George H. Thomas, and Joseph Hooker. All of these from both sides will play important roles in the Civil War, and they got their first real combat experience in the Mexican-American War. So obviously, one of the reasons that the Mexican-American War matters today is because of these generals and their effect on the Civil War, and because also of the massive addition of over a 500,000 square miles of land to the U.S. territory. This really set the stage for the fulfillment of the idea of manifest destiny that we talked about last episode. There was just so much land to the west of the Mississippi that Americans felt like they could just expand that way forever. But this made things harder for the Indian tribes that had moved west of the Mississippi during the Trail of Tears, because now there was this even less desirable land out in the desert that they could be relocated to, and this is exactly what's going to happen. Also, Mexico and the United States are going to have a very strained relationship for a long time. Mexico, as a country, has always struggled with corruption and smuggling. A huge part of Mexico's economy has always been its trade with the United States, some of which is in legitimate trade, and some of which is smuggling. Right now, somewhere between 3 and 10% of Mexico's economy is drug smuggling into the United States. According to a U.S. Senate report from just 2022, around 30% of Mexican territory is controlled by drug cartels. And the cartels exist to serve a certain type of demand, and that is the demand for drugs in the United States. And there's no legal way to bring that stuff in, so it's all smuggling. The cartels are also involved in human trafficking. So besides smuggling drugs, they're also smuggling humans across the border. They've got the infrastructure for it. The U.S.-Mexican border is almost 2,000 miles long. It's the 10th longest border in the entire world. As an aside here, just by the way, the longest is the U.S.-Canadian border, which for a variety of reasons is much more peaceful. But it's very difficult to control a 2,000-mile-long border, so it's always been a pathway for smuggling. The U.S.-Mexico border has also always been an entry point into the U.S. for illegal immigration. I've said before that I'm all in favor of legal immigration and that the U.S. has very, very liberal immigration policies compared to the rest of the world. But illegal immigration is a problem. And part of the problem is generated by the U.S. policy of jus soli. Jus soli, which loosely means the law of the soil, means that any baby born on U.S. soil is automatically a U.S. citizen. What this means is that even if someone enters the U.S. illegally and they have a baby, that baby will automatically become a U.S. citizen. So this results in people illegally crossing the border and then having a kid so that that kid will be a U.S. citizen. It's an incentive for people to sneak across to cross the border illegally. To be fair, Mexico also has a jus soli policy, but it's much less common for someone to sneak across the border into Mexico to go have a kid. But right now there is, as I've mentioned, a massive flood of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, and while there has always been a flow of illegal immigration from Mexico to the U.S., right now it seems to be more of an invasion than an immigration. The current administration seems to have actually encouraged this flood. From a historical point of view, mass immigration can have a very destabilizing effect on an area, which is maybe the point. A certain amount of immigration can be absorbed by a country without the country losing its culture. But if the immigration is overwhelming, the country can lose its identity. This is essentially what happened to Rome. Rome was overrun by barbarians who didn't share Roman values, and so they didn't assimilate into Roman society, but rather they toppled it. And like I said, maybe that's the point. So while I don't think it's time for another Mexican-American war, maybe it is time to re-examine the motives of a government that seems unconcerned about protecting its own citizens. Countries have boundaries and immigration policies for a reason, and that reason is to protect the ongoing livelihood and security of their existing citizens, the ones who are there legally and are paying the taxes and contributing to the existing society. And yes, it's good to have new people come into that society in a measured way, but too much immigration becomes a threat to the security, stability, and livelihoods of the existing citizens. feels like we in the U.S. are getting to that point. Many other people in places like the U.K., Sweden, Germany, and Italy, other Western countries, have recently experienced huge waves of undocumented immigration, and those people are also feeling this way. And it seems odd to many of us that the current governments are so accepting of this situation. Why would a government not protect its own existing citizens? I don't have a definitive answer, but I do know the general answer: corruption. The people in government are being paid by someone to look the other way. Are they being compromised by being bought, bribed, or extorted by some foreign enemy? Are they completely blinded by some empty ideology, by sort of wokeness that is broken from reality? Do the leaders of these countries actually hate their own citizens and want the citizens' lives to be harder? Is it all a spiritual thing? Like some kind of darkness has descended on these countries that were built on freedom and belief? I honestly don't know, though I'm leaning more and more to the idea that this is, at least in part, a spiritual thing, because it really does seem like an active evil to me. One of the points I've made a few times in this podcast is that the founding fathers of America, and some of the founding fathers of other countries as well, they shared a worldview that there was a God, and that there were such things as good and evil, and that mankind was basically sinful and corrupt and needed redemption. They also knew that corrupt men tend towards tyranny, and that's why the founding fathers tried to create a government that should have slowed the slide, at least somewhat, of the government towards tyranny. And like I said, it worked for a while. But we are about to see one of the most important of the checks and balances that the founding fathers created go away. And that is the idea of state sovereignty and states' rights. And the reason it's going to go away is because of the Civil War. And the reason that the Civil War starts is because of slavery, which is, of course, another example of human corruption and evil. But before we get to the Civil War, which is coming very soon, we have to first go even a bit further west than the Texas-Mexico border, going west to the Oregon Trail and to California, where apparently there's gold in them thar hills.